The bark came off in long strips under her fingernails, wet and soft as dead skin. Alara pressed the sharpened stone deeper into the birch trunk, dragging it downward in the shape of the first letter. E, then L, then A, then R, then A. Her name, the only word she could still give to the world, now that they had taken her tongue. She had been carving for 3 years, 3 years since the elder of the Ashfall Pack had held her jaw open over the punishment stone, while the healer cauterized what was left. 3 years of silence that was not silence at all, because the dead lands were full of sound. Wind through boneless trees, the crack of frost heaving stone apart, the low, wet breathing of things that lived in the hollows where nothing should live. She finished the last stroke of the A and stepped back. Her fingers were bleeding again, the cuticles split from cold and repetition, and she pressed them against the rough wool of her coat. The coat had belonged to someone taller. The sleeves hung past her knuckles, and the hem dragged in the ash that covered everything here like grey snow. She had found it on a body 2 winters ago, frozen solid against a fallen oak, and she had pried it free with the same patience she brought to everything now. Slow, methodical. Because rushing meant mistakes, and mistakes in the Deadlands meant you did not wake up. The tree she had just carved was the 407th. She knew because she counted them. Counting was something her mouth could not ruin. Numbers lived in her head, clean and precise. And when the nights grew so cold that her thoughts began to blur at the edges, she would count her trees instead of sheep. 407 trees, stretching back across the dead lands in a ragged line, that followed the ridges and valleys of what had once been the Thornwood territory, before the blight, before the wolves who lived here had either died or scattered into the surrounding packs like seeds thrown on stone. Elara had not scattered. She had been thrown. The Ashfall Pack had driven her out on the first night of winter 3 years ago. Beta Corwin had done the throwing, literally. His hand wrapped around the back of her neck as he marched her to the boundary cairn and shoved her past it. She remembered the specific feeling of his thumb pressing into the knob of her spine, the way her knees had buckled on the frozen ground, the taste of blood still fresh and copper bright in her mouth where her tongue used to be. "You will not survive the week," he had said. "That is the mercy of it." But Elara had survived the week. And the month, and the season, and then 3 years had passed, and she was still here, still breathing, still carving her name into every standing tree she could find, because if she could not speak her name, she would make the land speak it for her. She did not know yet that someone was reading. The morning after she carved the 407th tree, she woke to the smell of something wrong. Not the usual wrongness of the dead lands, the sulfur tang from the hot springs that bubbled up through cracks in the basalt, the sour sweetness of fungus eating through fallen timber. This was different. This was smoke. Wood smoke, specifically, the kind that came from a fire built with intention, with dry wood split along the grain and stacked in a proper hearth pattern. Someone else was here. Elara sat up in her shelter, a shallow cave tucked into a cliff face that she had lined with dried moss and pine boughs, carried from the edge of the living forest, 2 days' walk south. Her body protested the movement. Her left hip ached where she had fallen on ice 3 days ago. Her ribs were visible through her skin when she lifted her shirt to check the bruise spreading across her side, purple and green, like a map of a country she did not want to visit. She was thin. She had always been thin, even before. But 3 years of eating what the Deadlands offered, mushrooms and lichen, and the occasional rabbit caught in her snare traps, had pared her down to something architectural. Bones and angles, and the suggestion of a person. She pulled on her boots. The left one had a hole in the sole that she had patched with birch bark and pine resin. And it crackled when she walked, a sound like someone crumpling paper. She emerged from the cave into grey morning light and stood very still, her nostrils flaring. The smoke was coming from the north. From the direction of the old Thornwood settlement, the cluster of stone foundations and collapsed roofs that marked where a pack had once lived before the blight turned their territory into this. Ash and silence, and things growing in the wrong direction. No one went to the old settlement. There was nothing there but ghosts and bad air. Elara should have gone the other way. South, toward the snare lines. East, toward the stream, where she filled her water skins. Any direction that was not toward the smoke and whatever had made it. But something pulled at her. Not curiosity exactly. Something lower and older, like a hook set deep in her sternum, tugging. She followed it. The old settlement sat in a bowl between two ridges, and she approached from the eastern ridge, keeping low, her body pressed against the ground as she crawled to the lip and looked down. What she saw made her breath stop in her chest. There were wolves below. Not the thin, feral things that sometimes passed through the Deadlands, ribs showing, eyes yellow with desperation. These were enormous. Warwolves. Their fur was dark, black, and deep brown, and one that was silver-gray, and they moved with the controlled precision of animals that had never known hunger. There were perhaps 20 of them, fanned out across the old settlement in a search pattern, their noses to the ground, and in the center of them stood a man. He was tall in the way that mountains are tall, the kind of height that made you recalculate your understanding of scale. His shoulders were broad beneath a black leather coat that fell to his knees, and his dark hair was pulled back from a face that looked like it had been carved from the same basalt that made up the cliffs. Sharp jaw, heavy brow, a scar that ran from his left temple to the corner of his mouth, white against brown skin, pulling his lip into something that was not quite a smile and not quite a snarl. His eyes were amber, not brown, not hazel. Amber, like pine resin held up to firelight, and they were scanning the tree line with the focused intensity of a predator that had caught a scent but not yet located the source, the Alpha King of the Ironhold. She knew him by reputation. Everyone did. Cale Blackthorn had unified three territories through a combination of military brilliance and the kind of brutality that made other alphas check their borders twice. He was the youngest Alpha King in 4 generations, and the deadliest. The stories said his wolf was a beast that even he could barely control. A creature of black fur and golden eyes that had once torn through an entire enemy flank without slowing. The stories said he had never taken a Luna, because no wolf could match him. Because his beast rejected every female presented to him. Because he was waiting for something that might not exist. The stories said a lot of things. Elara had stopped listening to stories when she lost her tongue. She watched from the ridge as Cale Blackthorn walked to one of the trees at the edge of the settlement. A tree she had carved. He stood in front of it for a long time, his fingers tracing the letters cut into the bark, and then he turned and said something to one of the wolves. The wolf shifted, bones cracking and reforming, and became a man. Lean, red-haired, with a face full of freckles and an expression that suggested he spent most of his time trying not to get killed by the man standing next to him. Elara could not hear their words from this distance. but she could read the Alpha King's lips well enough to catch fragments. The same name. Every tree. And then more clearly because he turned toward her ridge as he said it. Who is she? She should have run. Every survival instinct she had developed over 3 years in the Deadlands screamed at her to slide back from the ridge and disappear into the network of cabs and gullies she knew better than her own heartbeat. But the hook in her sternum pulled tighter, and her wolf, the wolf that had been silent since the day they took her tongue, the wolf she had believed was dead, stirred. It was like a match struck in a dark room, a flare of heat behind her ribs that made her gasp. Her wolf opened one eye, metaphorically speaking, and the sound it made inside her mind was not a growl or a whine. It was a single word, pressed into her consciousness with the weight of absolute certainty. Mate, no. No, that was not possible. Elara pressed her forehead against the cold ground and squeezed her eyes shut. She was a tongueless Omega exiled to a wasteland. He was the Alpha King. The mate bond did not work like that. It did not reach across the gap between what he was and what she was. It could not. It should not. But her wolf did not care about should. Her wolf was standing now, fully awake for the first time in 3 years, and the heat spreading through Elara's body was making her hands shake against the frozen ground. Below, the Alpha King went very still, his chin lifted, his nostrils flared, and then his amber eyes locked onto the ridgeline exactly where she lay, as if he could see through the rock and scrub brush, as if he could feel the same hook pulling at his own chest. Elara did the only thing that made sense. She ran. She was fast, faster than a woman her size and condition should have been. 3 years of navigating the Deadlands on foot had built a kind of desperate efficiency into her movement. She knew every root, every loose stone, every place where the ground dropped away without warning. She slid down the back of the ridge on her heels, caught herself on a boulder, and sprinted into the twisted forest of dead birches that covered the eastern slope. Behind her, she heard it. A howl. Not the howl of a wolf calling its pack. She knew that sound intimately. This was different. This was the sound of something ancient and enormous and furious at the idea that what belonged to it was moving away. The howl rolled across the dead lands like thunder, bouncing off cliff faces and rattling the bare branches above her, and every small creature within a mile went silent. She kept running. The dead birch forest was her territory. She knew the paths, the gaps between trunks that a larger body could not fit through, the places where the ground was solid and where it would crumble. She wove through the trees like thread through a needle, her breathing harsh and ragged, the birch bark sole of her boot crackling with every step. Behind her, she could hear crashing, branches breaking, the sound of something massive moving through the forest without any regard for obstacles, simply going through them. He was in wolf form. She knew it without looking. No human body made that sound. She reached the creek bed, dry in summer, but now flowing with thin, ice-cold water, and splashed through it, hoping the water would break her scent trail. She climbed the far bank on her hands and knees, her fingernails tearing on the frozen mud, and scrambled into the rock field beyond. Here, the ground was nothing but basalt boulders tumbled together like dice, and she could move between them in ways that a wolf his size could not. The crashing stopped. She pressed herself into a gap between two boulders and held her breath. Her heart was slamming against her ribs so hard she could feel it in her teeth. The bruise on her side screamed. Her wolf was howling inside her mind, not in fear, but in frustration, clawing at the inside of her skull as if trying to turn her body around by force. "Go back," her wolf demanded. "Go back, go back, go back." She clamped down on the voice with everything she had. Minutes passed. The water in the creek bed murmured. A raven called somewhere overhead, its voice like a rusty hinge. Alara pressed her bleeding fingers against the cold stone and waited. Then she heard him. Not his wolf. Him. His human voice, deep and rough-edged, carrying across the rock field with the ease of a man accustomed to giving orders that moved armies. "I know you are there." His voice had an accent she could not place, something that turned his vowels heavy and round. "I felt you on the ridge. My wolf felt yours." "You know what that means." She closed her eyes. "I have been following your carvings for 6 days. He paused. "Alara. That is your name, is it not? You carved it into 400 trees. 407, she thought. But she could not say it. "I am not going to hurt you." The tone shifted. Something in it cracked just slightly, like ice on a river that was warmer than it looked. "I have been looking for you for 11 years. My wolf has been looking for you since the day I shifted for the first time. Do you understand? I have walked through territories and courts and battlefields, and I have never felt what I felt on that ridge. Come out. Please." The please landed on her, like a physical thing. She had never heard an alpha say please. Certainly not the Alpha King, the man whose name made other alphas lower their eyes. The word sounded strange in his mouth, like he was not accustomed to the shape of it, and that strangeness made it feel more real than any command he could have given. She did not come out, but she shifted her weight, and a pebble rolled free from the boulder she was pressed against, and that tiny sound was enough. She heard the soft impact of boots on stone, moving closer, and then his shadow fell across the gap where she was hiding, and he crouched down and looked at her. This close, his eyes were not just amber. There were flecks of darker gold in them, like sparks caught in resin, and the scar on his face was thicker than it had looked from the ridge, ropey and white, the kind of scar that came from a wound that should have killed. He smelled like wood smoke and leather, and something underneath that was wilder, pine needles crushed between fingers, rain on hot stone. Her wolf went silent. Not calm, overwhelmed. He looked at her for a long time. His gaze moved over her face, her matted hair, the oversized coat, the blood on her fingertips. Something shifted in his expression. The predatory focus softened, not into pity, she would have hated pity, but into something more like recognition, as if he were seeing not what she was, but what she had survived. "You are hurt," he said quietly. She shook her head. Not because she was not hurt, but because hurt was such an insufficient word for what she was. He extended his hand. Large. Calloused. A thin scar running across the back of it from thumb to wrist. He held it there, palm up, the way you might offer your hand to an animal that had been beaten too many times to trust. She did not take it. Instead, she reached for the flat stone she kept in her coat pocket, the one she had sharpened to a chisel point for carving. She pulled it out, and he tensed, his amber eyes dropping to the stone, and for a moment she saw the alpha in him, the part that assessed every object as a potential weapon. But she turned the stone over and pressed the sharpened edge against the flat rock between them, and carved quickly in rough letters. "I cannot speak," he read the words. His jaw tightened. The muscles in his throat worked as if he were swallowing something that tasted like iron. "Who did this to you?" She carved again. The scraping sound echoed between the boulders. "My pack." Something happened to his eyes. The amber darkened, the way a sunset goes from gold to blood red in the space between one breath and the next. his pupils contracted to points. A growl started in his chest, low and sustained, the kind of vibration you felt in your bones before you heard it with your ears. It was not directed at her. She knew that with a certainty that bypassed logic. The growl was for whoever had held her down and cut out her tongue, and it was the sound of something that intended to kill. He controlled it. Barely. His fingers curled against the stone until his knuckles blanched white, and then he uncurled them, one by one, with the deliberate care of a man who knew exactly how much damage his hands could do. "What pack?" he asked. "Ashfall." He knew the name. She could see it in the way his face hardened, the recognition followed by something like calculation. The Ashfall pack was not small. It controlled territory along the southern border of the Deadlands, a mid-sized pack with a mid-ranked alpha and a reputation for cruelty that even other packs found excessive. "Why?" he asked. She hesitated. The sharpened stone hovered over the rock. This was the part she had never told anyone, because there had been no one to tell, and because the truth was the kind of thing that got you killed faster than silence. She carved one word, "Bloodline." His breath caught. She watched his nostrils flare again, and this time he leaned closer. Close enough that she could feel the heat radiating from his body. Close enough that her wolf whimpered with the effort of not pressing forward into that warmth. He inhaled deeply, and his eyes widened. "You smell like moonflower," he said, his voice strange and raw. "Like moonflower, and something else, something old." "What bloodline?" She shook her head. "Not yet. Not here, crouched between boulders in the Deadlands, bleeding from her fingertips, her body shaking from cold and adrenaline and the mate bond screaming through every nerve she had. She could not give him that." He studied her. Then he nodded, once, short. The nod of a man who understood strategic patience, even when everything in him was howling for answers. "Will you come with me?" he asked. "Not as a prisoner, not as an Omega. As my guest, I have a camp, food, fire, healers." She carved into the stone again. "Why?" "Because you are my mate." He said it simply, without ceremony, the way you might say because the sky is blue or because water runs downhill. A fact, immutable. And because whoever cut out your tongue is going to answer for it. But that can wait until you have eaten. It was the last part that broke through her defenses. Not the declaration of the mate bond, not the promise of violence on her behalf. The simple acknowledgement that she was hungry, and that hunger came before revenge. She took his hand. His fingers closed around hers, and the contact sent a shock up her arm that was not pain and not pleasure, but some third thing, a recognition at the cellular level, as if every atom in her body had been waiting to align with every atom in his. He stood, pulling her gently to her feet, and she realized how much taller he was when she was standing next to him. The top of her head barely reached his collarbone. She felt small in a way that should have been frightening, but was not. He did not let go of her hand. They walked back through the rock field, through the dead birch forest, where he had torn a path wide enough for a cart, branches shattered and trunks gouged by claws the size of kitchen knives. Through the creek bed, the cold water soaking through her patched boot, toward the old settlement where his wolves were waiting. The red-haired man was the first to see them. His mouth fell open. He looked at their joined hands, at Alara's ragged appearance, at the expression on his Alpha King's face, and he went very pale beneath his freckles. "My lord," he said carefully, "is she..." Mine, Kail said. The word was quiet and absolute. Prepare the tent. Send for Maran. She needs food and medical attention. The camp came to life around her. Wolves shifted and dressed. A tent was erected. Not a soldier's field tent, but something larger, with thick canvas walls and a brazier burning inside that filled the space with warmth so sudden her skin tingled. A woman appeared, tall, with grey streaked hair pulled into a braid and hands that moved with the confidence of someone who had been healing wolves since before Alara was born. Maran, the healer, did not ask questions. She looked at Alara's bleeding fingers and clicked her tongue. She looked at her ribs and pressed her lips together. She looked inside Alara's mouth, where the stump of her tongue sat like a pink stone, and her expression did not change, but her hands trembled for a moment before she steadied them. 3 years, Maran said, not to Alara, but to Kail, who stood in the entrance of the tent with his arms crossed, watching everything. She has been like this for 3 years. The scarring is complete. Whoever did this knew what they were doing. They cauterized it to prevent regeneration. Kael said nothing, but the canvas of the tent entrance rippled as if something enormous had pressed against it from outside, and Alara realized his wolf was trying to come through, trying to shift. He was holding it back with sheer will, and the effort was visible in the cords of his neck, the white ring around his irises. Maran brought food. Not the elaborate meals Alara imagined an Alpha King's camp might produce, but practical things. Bone broth in a wooden cup, thick with marrow fat and flavored with wild thyme. Soft bread that had been steamed rather than baked, easy to eat without chewing. A handful of dried berries, dark as ink, that burst on her remaining tongue with a sweetness so intense it made her eyes water. She ate slowly. She had learned the hard way that eating too fast after prolonged hunger brought it all back up again. Kail watched her eat with an expression she could not read, his amber eyes tracking each movement of her hands, each careful sip of broth. When she paused, he sat down across from her, his long legs folded beneath the low table, and placed a piece of charcoal and a sheet of parchment in front of her. This will be easier than stone, he said. She looked at the charcoal, at the parchment, at his face, which was holding itself in careful neutrality, while something vast and barely contained moved behind his eyes. She picked up the charcoal and wrote. Her handwriting was shaky, unpracticed on anything other than stone and bark. You said you followed my carvings for 6 days, he nodded. We entered the Deadlands from the north, surveying the territory. The blight has receded enough that I am considering reclaiming it. My scouts found the first tree on the second day. By the fourth, they had counted over 100, all bearing the same name. I came to find who was carving it, and why, she wrote again. You thought it was a trap. The corner of his mouth moved. Not quite a smile. I thought it might be. But my wolf was insistent. He paused. I should explain. My wolf has been difficult for as long as I can remember. Aggressive, uncontrollable in ways that have cost me. He does not listen to me. He does not respond to dominance displays or calming techniques. The only time he has ever been still, truly still, was when I touched the first tree with your name on it. He went quiet in a way I have never experienced, like a storm breaking. She stared at him. I followed the carving south, he continued. Each tree brought him further to rest. By the sixth day, I was not following a trail. I was following a feeling, a pull. He touched his own chest, pressing his fist against his sternum. Here. And then I caught your scent on the ridge, and I understood. She wrote, I am an Omega. I do not care, she wrote again, pressing harder. I have no wolf. I have not shifted in 3 years. I have no tongue, no pack, no name except what I carved into dead trees. I am nothing that belongs beside an alpha king. He read the words. Then he reached across the table and took the charcoal gently from her fingers. He did not write with it. He set it down, and then he took both her hands in his, turning them over, examining the broken nails and split cuticles and the calluses built up by 3 years of carving stone into wood. These hands, he said, wrote your name 407 times across a wasteland. He counted them. He had counted them, just as she had. That is not nothing. That is someone refusing to be erased. She pulled her hands free. Not because his touch repelled her, but because the tenderness of it was worse than anything the Ashfall Pack had ever done to her. Cruelty she could survive. Kindness after this long might actually break her. She took the charcoal back. I need time, he nodded. He stood. At the entrance of the tent, he paused. You will not run again, he said. It was not a command. It was somewhere between a question and a hope. And the uncertainty in his voice did not match anything she knew about the Alpha King of the Ironhold. She did not answer, which was itself an answer, and they both knew it. He posted guards. Not around her, exactly, but around the camp, wolves patrolling in wide circuits that happened to enclose the area where her tent stood. Elara lay on the pallet Maren had prepared, clean blankets that smelled like cedar and lavender, and stared at the canvas ceiling and listened to her wolf pace inside her mind like a caged animal that had just been shown the door of its cage. She slept eventually, and in her sleep, she dreamed of the day they took her tongue. It had not been about punishment. That was the lie Elder Greaves had told the pack, that Elara had spoken forbidden words, had invoked old magic, had defied the laws of the Ashfall. The truth was simpler and worse. Elder Greaves had looked into her mouth and seen what lived there. Not her tongue, her voice. The particular resonance it carried, a frequency that made wolves lower their heads without meaning to, that made the wind change direction, that made seedlings push through frozen ground. The voice of the Mooncallers. The Mooncaller bloodline was supposed to be extinct. The last known Mooncaller, a woman named Seraphine, had disappeared 20 years ago under circumstances that the packs preferred not to discuss. She had been Elara's mother. Elara had never known her. She had been raised by the Ashfall Pack as an orphan, an omega, a nobody, and she had kept her head down and her mouth mostly shut and her voice carefully bland and unremarkable. But Elder Greaves was old enough to remember Seraphine, and when Elara was 19, she had been working in the Pack's herb garden, alone, singing to herself without thinking. And the dead rosemary had come back to life under her hands. Green shoots pushing through brown stems. Flowers opening in December. Greaves had been watching from the kitchen window. The tongue came out that night. Without it, her voice was broken. The Mooncaller gift lived in the precision of vocalization, in the specific shapes a tongue made against teeth and palate, in the vibration patterns that could not be replicated by any other means. Take the tongue. Take the power. That was what Greaves had calculated, and he had been right. In 3 years, Elara had not been able to call so much as a dandelion from the frozen ground. But the blood remained. The bloodline was in her cells, in the particular scent of moonflower that her skin produced even in the Deadlands. In the way her wolf, dormant as it was, made the shadows around her camp move in strange patterns that had nothing to do with the wind. Kael Blackthorn smelled it. His wolf smelled it. And now they were here, and Alara lay awake in the dark and thought about what it meant to be found after you had spent 3 years making sure the world knew where you were. She carved her name into every tree. Of course, someone would eventually read it. Maybe she had been calling him all along. Morning arrived gray and cold, as mornings in the Deadlands always did. Alara emerged from the tent to find the camp in quiet motion. Wolves eating, sharpening weapons, tending horses. The red-haired man, whose name she learned was Declan, was arguing with another soldier about the best route south and stopped mid-sentence when he saw her. "My lady," he said, and she almost looked behind herself to see who he was addressing. Kael was standing at the perimeter of the camp, talking to a pair of scouts who had just returned from a patrol. He turned when she appeared, and the way his body oriented toward her was involuntary and total, like a compass needle swinging to north. The scouts noticed. Everyone noticed. The Alpha King's attention had shifted, and in a pack, attention was everything. She walked to him. He met her halfway. "Good morning," he said. "Did you sleep?" She held up the parchment she had brought from the tent. She had written on it before coming out. "Who told you about the Deadlands? Who sent you here?" He read the note. "No one sent me. I told you, I was surveying the territory for reclamation. The Blight has been retreating for 2 years. The land is coming back," she wrote quickly. "The Blight does not retreat on its own." He looked at her with renewed interest. "What do you mean?" She hesitated, then wrote, "Something has been healing it. Slowly. From the south. I have watched it for 3 years. The fungi recede. The trees bud. The hot springs cool. It moves outward, like a circle expanding." "From what center?" She did not write. She pointed at herself. The silence that followed was not empty. It was full, packed with implication, and she watched his mind work behind his amber eyes, connecting pieces, fitting her into a framework larger than either of them. "The moon callers," he said slowly, "could heal blighted land." She nodded. "But you said your power was taken with your tongue," she wrote. "My conscious power, what I could control. But blood does not stop being blood because you lose a finger. The passive effect, the thing that exists because I exist, continues. I have just been too broken to direct it." He stared at the parchment for a long time. Then he looked up at the dead lands around them, at the gray ash and the skeletal trees and the strange, sulfurous light. And she watched him see what she had been too close to notice. The camp was sitting at the edge of a zone where the trees still had bark, where the ground was dark with actual soil instead of ash, where, if you looked carefully at the base of the boulders, there were tiny green things pushing up. Moss, lichen, the first tentative suggestions of life returning. The circle was centered on her cave, where she had lived for 3 years, and it was expanding. "How far?" he asked. She wrote, "About 6 miles in every direction now." He let out a breath. Then he said something she did not expect. "This is why they wanted you silent. Not your pack. The other packs. The council." She went still. "I sit on the council, Alara." He was watching her face. "I have for 3 years. And in that time, Elder Greaves of the Ashfall has argued repeatedly against reclaiming the Deadlands. He has claimed the Blight is permanent, irreversible, a natural consequence of the old wars. He has used it as justification for expanding Ashfall territory southward into lands that belonged to smaller packs." He looked at her parchment, at the word bloodline, and his jaw set. "He cut out your tongue because your power could undo everything he has built." She had not known that. She had thought it was simple fear, an old man terrified of an old bloodline. But this was political. Greaves had used the Deadlands as leverage. A moon caller healing the blight would destroy his argument and his territorial gains in one stroke, she wrote. He told the pack I was dangerous, that my voice was a weapon, that I had tried to use it against the Elder. Kael read the note, and the growl started again, that deep, seismic rumble that she felt in her back teeth. But this time, he did not control it as quickly. His eyes flickered, amber to something darker, and for a moment, she saw the beast looking out from behind the man's face, enormous and black-furred and ancient in its rage. She did something instinctive. She reached out and pressed her palm flat against his chest, over his heart, and the growl cut off like a switch had been thrown. His wolf blinked. His eyes cleared. He looked down at her hand on his chest, and then at her face. And what she saw in his expression was not surprise, but confirmation. Only you, he said quietly. For 11 years, no one has been able to quiet him, only you. They stood like that, for a moment, that stretched longer than it should have, her hand on his chest, his heartbeat steady and enormous under her palm. The bond hummed between them like a wire drawn taut, and she could feel his wolf pressing forward, wanting to be closer, wanting to curl around her and never move. She dropped her hand, she wrote. I need you to understand something. I am not the woman you imagined as your mate. I cannot speak your name. I cannot call your wolf. I am scarred and damaged, and I have been alone so long I do not remember how to be otherwise. He read her words. Then he took the charcoal from her hand and wrote on the parchment, his handwriting surprisingly elegant for a man with hands that large. I did not imagine you. I followed your name carved into 407 trees across a dead land. You are exactly who I was meant to find. She blinked against a sudden and furious heat behind her eyes. He returned the charcoal. And then, because he was apparently a man who understood when to press forward and when to step back, he turned to Declan and began giving orders for the day's patrol, as if the most significant moment of his life had not just occurred between two boulders in a wasteland. Elara retreated to her tent and sat on the pallet and pressed her hands against her face and shook. The days that followed established a pattern. Kael did not push. He did not demand she accept the bond or return with him to Ironhold or do anything other than exist in proximity to him while his wolves surveyed the Deadlands. He gave her space. He gave her parchment and charcoal in unlimited supply. He gave her food, real food, 3 times a day, and she felt her body responding, the hollows of her cheeks filling, the ache in her bones receding as proper nutrition reached marrow that had been starving for years. He also gave her something she had not had in 3 years. Conversation. Every evening, he came to her tent after the camp had settled, and they talked after a fashion. He spoke. She wrote. The exchange was slower than spoken conversation, more deliberate, and because of that, it was denser. Nothing was wasted. Every word she carved into parchment was a word she had chosen with precision, and he responded to that precision with his own. She learned that he had inherited the Ironhold at 19 when his father died in battle. She learned that his wolf had nearly destroyed him that year, breaking free during a council meeting and savaging the table before Kael dragged it back under control, an incident that had paradoxically cemented his reputation because the other alphas interpreted uncontrollable power as power itself. She learned that the scar on his face was from his own wolf, from a night when the beast had fought the man so hard that Kael's claws had torn through his own skin in the struggle. I was 17, he said, sitting in her tent while the brazier hissed and popped. My wolf wanted to go north. I did not understand why. I held him back. He punished me for it. She wrote, north, toward here, he nodded. Toward you. You would have been 14, already in Ashfall territory. She stared at the charcoal in her hand and did the math. If his wolf had found her at 14, before Greaves, before the punishment stone, before the blade and the cauterizing iron, he seemed to read the thought on her face. I know, he said. I think about it too. She wrote, it would not have changed things. Greaves would have acted sooner, perhaps, but you would not have been alone. He looked at her across the low table, and the firelight turned his amber eyes to something liquid and deep. You would never have been alone. She set down the charcoal, because her hand was shaking too badly to write. That night, after he left, she lay awake and felt the bond between them like a second pulse, steady and warm. And she made a decision, not to accept it, not yet, but to stop running from it. In the morning, she showed him her trees. They walked together through the deadlands, following the trail of carvings south. She led him to the oldest ones, the first trees she had carved 3 years ago, near the boundary cairn, where Beta Corwin had thrown her out. These carvings were weathered, the letters soft with age, and small things were growing in the grooves. Moss, mostly, and a tiny fern that had taken root in the curve of the R, life from her name. She had not noticed that before. Kael ran his fingers over the carvings, as he had on the first day. But now she was standing beside him instead of watching from a ridge, and she could see the expression on his face in full. It was not the face of a king assessing territory. It was the face of a man reading a message meant for him, even if the writer had not known it. You wrote to me, he said. Every tree. You did not know it, but you were writing to me. She shook her head and tapped her charcoal against the parchment she carried. I wrote to prove I existed. That is all. He looked at her. And I found you because of it. So perhaps the result is the same. They had walked for 2 hours when they heard the howl. It came from the south, from the direction of the Ashfall border, and it was not an Ironhold wolf. The pitch was wrong, higher and harsher, and it carried a pattern that Ilara recognized with a sickness that rose from her stomach to her throat. 3 short, 1 long. The Ashfall tracking call. They were looking for her. Kael heard it too, and his reaction was immediate and total. His body shifted, not physically but in bearing, from the man who had been walking beside her, reading tree carvings to the Alpha King, who had unified 3 territories and won battles that no one thought he could win. His spine straightened, his chin dropped, his eyes went flat and hard. How many? He asked. She held up both hands, spread her fingers, closed them, spread them again. 20. He almost smiled. It was not a kind smile. That is not enough, he said. Come. But the Ashfall wolves were faster than he expected, or they had been closer than the howl suggested. They came out of the dead forest in a loose crescent, 15 wolves and 5 men, and at the center of them walked a figure Ilara had hoped never to see again. Elder Greaves was old, 70, maybe older, with a face like leather left in the sun too long, and hands that trembled with a palsy he disguised by keeping them clasped behind his back. His eyes were grey, not the bright grey of new steel, but the dull grey of old dishwater, and they settled on Ilara with a satisfaction that made her skin crawl. There she is, Greaves said. His voice was reedy and thin, the voice of a man who had never needed volume because he had other people to do his shouting. Our little runaway. We have been looking for you. Kael stepped between them. The effect was physical. The Ashfall wolves, all of them, shrank. It was not a conscious choice. It was their wolves responding to the presence of a superior predator, the way rabbits freeze when a hawk's shadow passes over. Kael did not even have to speak. He simply existed in the space between Greaves and Ilara, and his existence was a wall. Greaves was old enough and shrewd enough not to show his fear, but Ilara saw it in the way his clasped hands tightened behind his back. "Alpha King," Greaves said, with a bow that was precisely calibrated, deep enough for respect, but not deep enough for submission. "We did not expect to find you in the Deadlands. This is Ashfall territory. This is unclaimed territory," Kael said. His voice was conversational, almost pleasant, the way a blade is pleasant before it cuts. "The dead lands belong to no pack. I have been surveying them for reclamation." "Reclamation?" Greaves's mouth thinned. "The blight is permanent. We have discussed this in council, and yet." Kael glanced at the ground around them, where tiny green shoots were pushing through the ash. "Here we are." Greaves followed his gaze, and Ilara saw the moment he understood. His dishwater eyes moved from the green shoots to Ilara, and the satisfaction drained from his face like water from a cracked bowl. "You know," he said, "it was not a question." "I know," Kael confirmed. "I know what she is. I know what you did to her. And I know why." The Ashfall wolves shifted uneasily. Some of them were looking at Ilara with new eyes, wolves who had grown up being told she was a dangerous Omega, a threat to the pack, and who were now watching their elder's face collapse and recalculating everything they had been told. "She is Ashfall property," Greaves said. His voice had gone hard, the reedy quality replaced by something sharper. "An Omega under our jurisdiction. You have no claim to her." Kael turned his head slightly, and the motion was so deliberate, so controlled, that it was more threatening than any snarl. "She is my mate," he said, "and you cut out her tongue." The words landed in the clearing like stones, dropped into still water. The Ashfall wolves went absolutely still. Even Greaves, for all his political acuity, could not keep the flicker of fear from crossing his face. And then he did something that surprised Ilara. He looked at her directly, past Kael's shoulder. And for one moment, just one, the mask dropped. She saw the old man underneath, the one who had been 25 when Seraphine, her mother, had been alive and singing, and who had listened to that singing with something that was not just fear. There was grief in his face, not for Ilara, for himself, for the choices he had made and could not unmake, for the young man he had been before the politics and the territory, and the calculation had turned him into something that could hold a girl's jaw open over a stone. It lasted one breath. Then the mask returned, and he was Elder Greaves again, cold and pragmatic and fighting for survival. "I did what was necessary," he said. "The Mooncaller bloodline is not a gift. It is a weapon. Her mother nearly destroyed the balance of power among the packs. I prevented her daughter from doing the same." "By mutilating a child," Kael said. "By protecting my people." Kael looked at him for a long moment. Then he said, very quietly, "We will discuss this further. At council. With all the packs present. Until then, she stays with me." "She is ours. She is mine." The word was not spoken loudly, but it carried the weight of every wolf in Kael's command, every battle he had won, every territory he had claimed. It was not volume. It was gravity. "She is mine." Greaves looked at the 15 wolves he had brought with him. He looked at the Ironhold camp visible on the ridge behind them, where 20 warwolves and 50 soldiers waited. He did the math, and because he was a survivor above all things, he bowed again, deeper this time, and stepped back. "We will discuss this at council," he agreed. But his dishwater eyes found Alara's as he turned, and the message in them was clear. "This is not over." The Ashfall wolves withdrew. Kael stood motionless until the last of them disappeared into the dead forest. Then the control that had held him in human form cracked, and Alara felt the shift before she saw it. A wave of heat and pressure, like standing too close to an explosion, and then where the man had been, there was a wolf. He was massive, larger than any wolf she had seen, larger even than the warwolves in his command. His fur was black, not the dull black of shadow, but a deep, oil-slick black that seemed to absorb light and give nothing back. His eyes were the same amber, bright as lit windows in a dark house, and they found Alara's with an intensity that was both animal and profoundly human. He walked to her. The ground shook with each step, slightly, like a minor tremor. He lowered his enormous head until his muzzle was level with her face, and he breathed in, a long, slow inhalation that ruffled her hair and raised the fine hairs on her arms. Then he pressed his forehead against hers. The contact was electric. The bond surged through her like current through a wire, and her wolf, dormant, damaged, presumed dead, stood up inside her mind and answered. Not with a howl, with something quieter and infinitely more powerful. A frequency, a vibration that started in Alara's chest and spread outward through her skin and into the ground beneath her feet. And where it passed, the ash stirred, and something green and impossible pushed through. Kael's wolf made a sound, a low, continuous rumble that was not a growl but a purr, vast and geological, the sound of something ancient finding rest. They stood like that, while the dead land around them bloomed. The council was held 10 days later, 10 days in which Alara ate and slept and healed, and felt her body returning from the architecture of starvation to something that resembled a living woman. Maren treated her injuries with the efficient tenderness of someone who had seen worse and had decided that seeing worse was no excuse for doing less. The bruise on her side faded from purple to yellow. The cracks in her fingers closed. The hole in her boot was replaced by actual boots, leather lined with wool, that fit her feet and did not crackle when she walked. Kael did not push, but he was present. Always present, in the way that mountains are present, not demanding attention, but impossible to ignore. He ate his meals within sight of her tent. He walked the perimeter of the camp every evening, and his route always passed her fire. He spoke to her through parchment notes that he left on her table when she was sleeping, brief messages that were part tactical update and part something else entirely. "The moss on your trees has spread another foot. Maren says your iron levels are improving." My wolf slept through the night for the first time in 11 years. "I thought you should know." She kept every note. She folded them into small squares and stored them in the pocket of her coat. The old coat she refused to give up despite the new one Maren had offered, because the old coat was proof that she had survived, and proof mattered. On the 8th day, she woke to find a single moonflower growing outside her tent, white-petaled, silver-scented, glowing faintly in the pre-dawn light. It was impossible. Moonflowers did not grow in the dead lands. Moonflowers barely grew anywhere anymore, not since the last mooncaller had vanished. It had pushed up through the ash in the night, right where she had stood when Kael's wolf pressed his forehead to hers. She stared at it. Then she knelt and cupped her hands around it, and felt something click into place inside her, like a key turning in a lock that she had not known was locked. Her wolf opened its eyes, fully, completely. Not the drowsy stirring of the ridge or the tentative reaching she had felt in Kale's presence. This was a full awakening, a supernova behind her ribs, and the power that rushed through her was not the careful, deliberate magic of vocalization. It was something raw, something that did not need a tongue. The ground around her rippled. Green spread outward from her knees like ink dropped in water, and within the span of a minute, the circle of life that had taken 3 years to reach 6 miles expanded another 100 feet. Moss erupted from stone. Fungi retreated. A dead birch tree, 10 feet from her tent, produced a single, trembling leaf. Behind her, Kale's voice. He had been watching from his own tent. Elara. She turned. She was crying. She had not cried in 3 years, because crying required a particular vulnerability that the dead lands did not allow. But now the tears were running down her face and dripping from her chin and landing on the ground. And where they landed, flowers bloomed. He was beside her in 3 strides. He did not ask permission. He gathered her against his chest, and she let him, because there was no version of this moment that made sense without his arms around her. And she pressed her face into the leather of his coat and wept silently, while the dead lands came alive around them. When she finally pulled back, she reached for her parchment and wrote 4 words. I am ready now, he read the words. He looked at her face, tear-streaked and flushed and lit from beneath by the glow of moonflowers that had not existed 10 minutes ago. And the Alpha King of the Ironhold, the man whose name made nations flinch, smiled. It was not the almost smile she had seen before, the scar-tugged grimace that passed for humor. It was a real smile, unguarded and slightly crooked, and so unexpectedly young that it took 10 years off his face. Then we go to council, he said. The Council of Pax met in the Hearthstone Hall, a massive underground chamber carved into the bedrock beneath the neutral grounds, the one territory that belonged to no pack and all packs simultaneously. The hall was lit by fire pits that lined the central aisle, and the stone walls were carved with the names and sigils of every pack that had ever held territory. The air smelled like old hoke and tallow, and the mineral tang of deep stone. 12 alphas sat at the long table. Greaves occupied the ashfall seat, his hands clasped on the table in front of him, his grey eyes fixed on the door. Beside him sat Beta Corwin, the man who had thrown Elara past the boundary cairn, thick-necked and blunt-faced, his expression a careful blank that suggested he had been told to keep his mouth shut and was finding it difficult. Kael entered first. The room shifted when he did, the other alphas straightening in their seats, some with respect, and some with the wary attention of animals that know they are outmatched. He was in formal attire, black from collar to boot, with the iron hold sigil pinned at his throat, a wolf's head wreathed in iron thorns. His scar was vivid under the firelight. He took his seat at the head of the table. Then he spoke. I have found my mate. The room went silent. 11 alphas leaned forward. Greaves did not move. She is outside. Before I bring her in, you need to understand what has been done to her. He paused, and the firelight made shadows in the hollows of his face. And by whom? He told them. Concisely, precisely, without embellishment. The Mooncaller bloodline. The mutilation. The exile. The 3 years in the Deadlands, carving her name into trees, because it was the only voice she had left. The healing of the blight, documented by his scouts, measurable, undeniable. When he finished, the room was not silent. It was loud with the absence of speech, every alpha processing what they had heard and calculating its implications. Greaves spoke. His voice was steady, which was impressive given that every eye in the room was on him. The Mooncaller bloodline is unstable. Seraphine nearly caused a war. I acted to prevent her daughter from doing the same. You acted to preserve your territory, said another alpha, a woman named Hessa from the Green Veil Pack, who had the broad shoulders and blunt manner of someone who did not tolerate being lied to. The Deadlands justified your expansion south, a Mooncaller. Healing the Blight would undo that. Let us be honest about what this was. Greaves turned his grey eyes on her. Politics and protection are not mutually exclusive. Cutting out a child's tongue is neither, Hessa said. She was 19, Greaves said, and the steadiness in his voice cracked just slightly, like a fracture running through stone. She was not a child. She was a grown woman with a power that could level this hall if she chose to use it. You did not hear her mother sing. I did. I was there when Seraphine sang the Thornwood Wolves into attacking their own pack. I was there when the Dead Lands were made. The Blight is not natural. It was Seraphine. She sang the land to death when the packs turned against her, and she disappeared. And we have been living with the consequences ever since. So yes, I cut out her daughter's tongue, and I would do it again. The room absorbed this, Kael said. And yet her daughter has spent 3 years healing the very wound her mother made. Without a tongue, without power, simply by existing. He let that sit. Which of those women does this council fear more? The one who destroyed? Or the one who healed? Greaves opened his mouth, closed it. His clasped hands were trembling on the table, the palsy he usually hid now visible to every alpha in the room. Kael stood. Bring her in, he said to Declan, who was standing at the door. Elara had been waiting in the corridor outside the hall, flanked by Maran and 2 Ironhold guards. She had been given new clothes, simple but well made. A dark green dress that was the first thing she had worn in 3 years that was not scavenged from a corpse. Her hair had been washed and brushed and fell past her shoulders in dark waves that were just beginning to recover their natural thickness. The scars on her hands were visible, the calluses and broken nails that 3 years of survival had built, and she did not hide them. She walked into the Hearthstone Hall and felt 12 alpha gazes hit her like spotlights. It would be wrong to say she was not afraid. She was terrified. Her heart was hammering, and her wolf was pacing, and the firelight was too bright after years of grey dead land light, and the smell of the hall, smoke and tallow and old stone, was overwhelming. But she had survived 3 winters in a wasteland with no tongue, and no pack, and no hope. Walking into a room full of alphas was not the hardest thing she had ever done. She passed Greaves without looking at him. She walked the length of the table. She stopped in front of Kael. He extended his hand. She took it. Then he turned her gently to face the council and said, "This is Elara, daughter of Seraphine. Last of the Mooncaller bloodline. My mate. Your future queen." The room erupted, not in violence, in argument, which among alphas was often the prelude to violence. Several were on their feet. Hessa was pointing at Greaves and saying something about accountability. Another alpha, a thin man from the coastal pack, was demanding proof of the bloodline claim. Beta Corwin had risen from his chair and was edging toward the door with the instinct of a man who recognized a sinking ship. Elara stood in the center of it and breathed. Then she did something no one expected. She dropped Kael's hand, walked to the nearest fire pit, and knelt beside it. She pressed her palms flat against the stone floor, and she pushed. The power moved through her like water through a broken dam. It was not the careful, directed force of a tongue shaping words into commands. It was the raw, unfiltered gift of the Mooncaller blood, channeled not through voice, but through contact, through skin touching stone, through the fundamental connection between a healer and the land she healed. The stone floor cracked. Not violently, gently. Thin fractures spreading outward from her palms in a radial pattern, and through each crack, green pushed. Moss first, then tiny ferns, then something thicker and stronger, a vine with dark leaves and white flowers that climbed the carved walls of the hearthstone hall and bloomed. Moonflowers. Dozens of them. Hundreds. The hall filled with their scent, silver and clean and ancient, and the firelight caught their petals and threw soft white reflections across the faces of 12 stunned alphas. Greaves stared. His hands had stopped trembling. His face was blank, not with calculation, but with something deeper. He was looking at the moonflowers, the way a man looks at the face of someone he wronged beyond redemption, knowing that no apology will ever be sufficient, and that the absence of an apology is its own kind of torture. The thin alpha from the coastal pack sat down heavily. Hesse whispered something that might have been a prayer. Kael was looking at Ilara with an expression that had moved past pride into territory that had no name, the look of a man watching the impossible happen, and understanding that the impossible had been sleeping beside him for 10 days, had been walking through his camp and eating his food and writing him notes on parchment, and he had not understood the full scope of what she was until this moment. Ilara stood. Her palms were bleeding where the stone had cut them, and the blood was not red. It was faintly silver. The Mooncaller mark. She pulled out her parchment and charcoal, and wrote in large letters that she held up for the room. I cannot speak, but I can heal. The dead lands will live again. This is not a weapon. This is a gift, and it was never his to take. She looked at Greaves on the last line. He looked back, and the moment that passed between them was not forgiveness, because forgiveness was not hers to give that easily. And it was not condemnation, because she was tired of being defined by what had been done to her. It was acknowledgement. I see what you did. I survived it. I am more than what you left me. Greaves lowered his eyes. Kael spoke into the silence. The Ashfall Pack has committed a crime against a Mooncaller, a protected bloodline under the old laws. Elder Greaves acted alone. His pack did not sanction the mutilation. This was generous, and everyone in the room knew it. It gave the Ashfall Wolves an exit, a way to separate themselves from their elder's choices. It also sealed Greaves's fate, because if the pack did not sanction it, then Greaves bore sole responsibility. The council voted. It was not close. 11-1. With only the Ashfall seat abstaining, though Beta Corwin's abstention looked more like agreement than disagreement. Greaves was stripped of his rank. His territory gains from the Dead Lands expansion were reversed. He was exiled, not to the Dead Lands, but to the Neutral Grounds, where he would live out his remaining years in the same isolation he had imposed on a 19-year-old girl. Greaves stood when the verdict was read. He looked at Ilara one more time, and his expression was not the one she had expected. Not rage, not defeat. Something more complicated. A weariness that went all the way to the bone. The exhaustion of a man who had spent 20 years afraid, and had finally been told he could stop. He walked out of the hearthstone hall without speaking. Beta Corwin took the Ashfall seat. He looked at Alara with an expression she could not read, guilt and relief and something that might have been shame. And he bowed his head. "My lady," he said, "the pack owes you a debt we cannot repay." She wrote on her parchment and held it up. "Then do not try, just do better." He read it. He nodded. He sat down. The council session lasted another 3 hours. Territory lines were redrawn. Plans for the Deadlands reclamation were discussed. Alara sat beside Kale and wrote her contributions on parchment, and the Alphas listened, because the woman who had healed the Hearthstone Hall with her hands was not someone you interrupted. When it was over, Kael walked her out of the hall and into the open air, and the night sky above the neutral grounds was thick with stars. She wrote one more note. "You called me your future queen." He read it. "I did," she wrote. "I have not accepted yet." He tilted his head. "Haven't you?" She looked at him, at his scarred face and amber eyes, and the way he stood, slightly angled toward her, as if his body could not help but orient in her direction. She thought about 407 trees, about 3 years of silence, about a wolf that had been dead and was now alive, about a man who had read her name in the bark of dead birches and followed it home to her. She put the parchment away. She took his face in both hands, her scarred palms against his scarred cheeks, and she pulled him down to her. The kiss was not gentle. It was not the careful, tentative first kiss of two people testing the waters. It was 3 years of silence meeting 11 years of searching, and it was desperate and fierce and tasted like charcoal and moonflowers and salt from tears neither of them would admit to later. His arms came around her with a force that lifted her off the ground, and the sound his wolf made was not a growl or a purr, but a cry, raw and broken, and finally, finally answered. When they broke apart, she was shaking, and he was shaking, and the ground around them had erupted in white flowers. The marking ceremony was held 3 days later in the Ironhold's Great Hall, a cavernous space of black stone and iron sconces where the pack gathered in ranks. Alara wore white, not a traditional choice but a deliberate one, the color of moonflowers, the color of the scars on her hands, the color of what grows in the cracks of things that should be dead. Kael stood before his pack in formal black, and the contrast between them, his darkness and her light, his size and her slightness, his voice and her silence, was not a mismatch. It was a balance, the kind that keeps the world from tipping. The old words were spoken. She could not say them, so Maran spoke on her behalf. The healer's steady voice carrying the vows through the hall, while Alara pressed her hand over her heart in the traditional gesture of oath. Then Kael lowered his mouth to the curve of her neck and shoulder, and his teeth broke the skin. The mark blazed, not with pain, with recognition. Every wolf in the hall felt it, the bond locking into place with an almost audible click, and Alara's wolf surged forward through the mark and met Kael's wolf on the other side, and the two of them tangled together in a space that existed outside of flesh, a space made of scent and warmth, and the absolute certainty that they would never be separate again. She gasped, not because of the bite, because in the moment the mark sealed, her wolf did something it had never done before. It spoke to his, not in words, because her wolf had no tongue either, but in the deeper language that wolves share, the language of presence and proximity, and the particular sounce that means I am here. I am staying. I am yours. Kael pulled back. His eyes were wet. The Alpha King of the Ironhold, the man who had unified 3 territories and won battles that should have been losses and held his murderous wolf in check for 11 years through sheer force of will, was crying in front of his entire pack. He did not try to hide it. The pack roared, not in surprise, in recognition. Their king had found his queen, and she was a woman who had carved her own name across a wasteland rather than be forgotten. And if that was not royalty, then the word had no meaning. Declan was crying too, which he would deny later, and which everyone would remember. Maren was not crying, but she was smiling, which for Maren was the emotional equivalent of a standing ovation. Elara stood in the center of it, her hand on the mark that burned warm on her neck, and felt the silence inside her change. It was not the silence of absence anymore. It was the silence of a room full of people holding their breath, not because they are afraid, but because they are witnessing something sacred. The months that followed were not easy. Healing the dead lands was not a single act, but a sustained effort, a daily practice of hands on stone and roots in ash, and the slow, stubborn insistence of life returning to a place that had forgotten how to live. Elara spent weeks at a time in the dead lands, Kale beside her, or as near as his duties allowed, and the green circle expanded mile by mile until it was no longer a circle, but a territory. The Thornwood territory, reborn. Wolves who had scattered from the Blight began returning. Cautiously at first, singles and pairs sniffing at the new growth, testing the air for sulfur, and finding only clean earth. Then families. Then small groups. They came to Elara not as subjects, but as survivors recognizing another survivor, and she welcomed them in the only way she could. She knelt and pressed her hands to the earth and made it bloom. She never regained her tongue. Maren consulted healers from 6 territories, and the consensus was what Elara had already known. The cauterization had been precise and permanent. The tissue would not regenerate. But she found other ways to speak. She learned a sign language that Maren developed for her, based on the old wolf gestures but expanded, and Kyle learned it with the dedication of a man who understood that love is not just a feeling, but a practice. Within a year, they could argue in sign language, which they did frequently and with great enthusiasm, because Elara had opinions about everything from territorial governance to the proper way to season venison, and Kyle had opinions about everything from military strategy to the fact that his mate worked too hard and slept too little. They were good arguments, the kind that made the Ironhold wolves exchange knowing looks and find reasons to be elsewhere. She wrote. She wrote constantly, filling parchment journals with observations about the land, about the Blight, about the Mooncaller bloodline, and what it meant. She wrote letters to the other packs, formal and precise, in a hand that grew steadier and more elegant with practice. She wrote notes to Kyle that she left on his pillow, short and specific, the way their entire relationship had been built. "Your wolf was restless last night. Come to the garden. Bring your hands." He always came. The evening she told him about the pregnancy, they were sitting in the garden she had grown in the courtyard of the Ironhold Keep. It was late autumn. The moonflowers were closing for the season, their white petals folding inward like hands in prayer, and the air smelled like cold earth and the particular sweetness of things preparing to sleep through winter. She handed him the parchment without preamble. "I am carrying your child." He read it. He set it down. He looked at her with an expression that began as shock and transformed, in the space of 3 seconds, through joy and terror and a fierce, consuming tenderness that made his amber eyes bright as struck flint. He did not speak. Instead, he reached out and placed his hand on her stomach, flat and warm. And his wolf pressed forward through the contact. And Elara felt the beast's presence against her skin enormous and gentle, a creature of war, bending down to listen for the heartbeat of something the size of a plum, the baby kicked. Too early for that, Maren would say later. Far too early for a kick to be felt. But they both felt it, a tiny percussion against Kyle's palm, and his face broke open in a way she had never seen. He pulled her into his lap, carefully, as if she were made of the same moonflowers that grew around them, and he pressed his face into her hair and breathed her in. Moonflower and earth and something new, a scent that was both of them and neither. The first trace of a person who did not yet exist, but was already changing everything. She put her hand over his hand on her stomach. The moonflowers opened, all of them, despite the season, despite the cold, despite every biological imperative telling them to close. They opened their white petals to the night sky and glowed, softly, silver, and the light they cast turned the garden into something from a story that neither of them would have believed if they were not living it. Kael said her name. Not as a king. Not as an alpha. As a man who had followed 407 carvings across a dead land and found, at the end of them, everything. Elara, he said. She pressed her forehead against his jaw. She could feel his pulse under her skin. She could feel the baby's pulse under his hand. She could feel the moonflowers reaching toward them, drawn by her blood, by the power that had survived mutilation and exile and 3 years of silence and was now, finally, growing into what it was always meant to be. She closed her eyes. In the Deadlands, the last of the ash was disappearing under new green growth. In the Ironhold, a pack was preparing for a child that would be both wolf and mooncaller, both iron and moonlight. In the Hearthstone Hall, a vine of white flowers climbed the walls where a tongueless woman had pressed her bleeding palms to stone and reminded 12 alphas what power actually looked like. And in the garden, in the glow of flowers that should not have been blooming, a woman who could not speak held the hand of a man who did not need her to. The last moonflower of the season curled its petals around a drop of early frost and held on.